Today's topic is Evolution Fails. And you're probably thinking that the title is incomplete. Evolution Fails what? But it actually turns out, you know, if you have a son or a daughter who's like under the age of 25, you'll know that the verb fail has been changed into a noun. Okay, so if you say something like, that's a fail, that means that it's some kind of failure. And so, and usually it's something really, really stupid. So, if you want to really emphasize it, you'll say, it's an epic fail. And so if you go to YouTube and put in the phrase like epic fail, you'll see things sort of like this. Now that is an epic fail.
Yeah.
Now here's another one.
Oh, that's great.
Okay, so those are epic fails. So today we are going to look at evolution's epic fails. Okay, so here we go. Okay, our first fail is Hedylepta, now, which is a banana-eating moth. Now, how many of you have heard of this best example of evolution? Raise your hands. It's the best example of evolution. Okay, so actually I hadn't heard about it until a few months ago, but there's an RTB apologist email list. And we email each other on different problems and stuff. And it came up because one of the apologist's sons had been studying at a Christian college. And during his first year, he became an evolutionist because of Hedylepta. Okay? So, you know, I had to look into it. And it actually comes from a televised evolution creation debate. And I'm going to show you a video excerpt, and this is the excerpt. Philip Johnson is the guy asking the question, and Kenneth Miller is responding.
In my discussion with Eugenie, we talked about the mechanism as the all-important thing, and the creative power of the mutation selection mechanism as to produce all this genetic information.
Indeed.
What is the most powerful demonstration, in your opinion, that the Darwinian mechanism of natural selection has this great creative power?
Well, I would give you, you're asking me for the most powerful one, and I will give you two. The first one that I will give you are the repeated observations of random mutation and natural selection, as you like to call them in your own terms, producing new species. And I can give you several examples of new species that have emerged within human observation. The best example that I can give you is a butterfly, a genus of butterfly known as Hedylepta. Hedylepta is a genus of butterfly that feeds on various plants. It's endemic to the Hawaiian Islands, which means it's only found there. And there turn out to be two species of Hedylepta with mouth parts that only allow them to feed on bananas. Now, why is that significant? It is significant because bananas are not native to the Hawaiian Islands. They were introduced about 1,000 years ago by the Polynesians. We know this from the written records of the Hawaiian Kingdom. And what that means is that by mutation and natural selection, these two species have emerged on the Hawaiian Islands within the last 1,000 years. And I think that's a very good case.
Okay, so everybody's convinced? Is that a good example of evolution?
It sounds like it.
It sounds like it. It sounds like a really good example. Now, Has anybody ever heard of Kenneth Miller? Do you know who Kenneth Miller is? Yeah?
I don't know who he is. I just heard him.
Okay. So, actually, anybody have kids in high school?
Okay. Is Miller your age?
No. He's not that old. So this is Miller Levine, who are the authors of California's biology textbook. Okay, so he's that Miller. Okay, so he ought to know what he's talking about, right? Okay, and it turns out that this story has made its way into a bunch of textbooks. Okay, so if you look in these textbooks, you'll see excerpts that talk about Hedy Lipta and how it's such a wonderful example of evolution. So it must be true, right? Right? It has to be true. Okay, so it turns out that the claim comes from this short 2-page article that was published by Elwood Zimmerman in 1960. However, contrary to what Miller said, Hedy Lipta is not a butterfly, it's a moth. And in the article it tells you that there are 5 banana-eating species, not 2. So obviously he got some of the details wrong. So I decided to research it to see exactly how many of the details are actually true. Okay, but in the article, it doesn't say anything about mouth parts that allow them to feed only on bananas. That's totally not in there. So okay, it gets better. It gets better. So how strong is the evidence? And most of the evidence actually comes from this volume, which is Insects of Hawaii, Volume 8, which was published by Zimmerman, same author, in 1958. And you can get this online through the University of Hawaii, which is great because you can actually look up the data. I love the internet. Okay, so there are 23 species of Hedy Lipta which are endemic to Hawaii. That means that they're only found in Hawaii. However, most of the species, when they were first identified, were put in the genus Omedes, okay, and not Hedy Lipta. But Zimmerman changed the name to Hedy Lipta in his 1958 volume. Now, Eugene Monroe changed the genus name back to Omedes in 1989. So Miller also got the genus name wrong, because it's been Omedes since 1989. Okay, now all the species except Omedes monogana eat various monocot species. Anybody know what a monocot is? Excellent. There's the biologist there. Okay. So you all got know what that means. Okay. So when you plant a seed, how many leaves come out?
One or two.
One or two. If it has one, it's a monocot. If it has two, it's a dicot. Okay. So and the monocots are. The other characteristic that they tend to have is the leaves tend to be parallel. So you'll look at things like grasses and palms and...
The venation of the leaves is parallel.
Okay, so you'll see things like grasses and palms, bananas, and these are the kinds of things that these moths eat. Actually, the caterpillars eat, of course. Okay. So these 5 species are the 5 species that feed only on bananas, according to Zimmerman. Okay. Now, soon after the discovery, several species of Omedes, including all the banana-eating species, came under heavy predation by parasitic wasps. And the wasps were introduced into Hawaii to control non-native caterpillars that were eating their crops. But it turns out that the wasp parasitized more than just the bad caterpillars. They also went off onto the native caterpillars. And of course, this would have never been allowed, you know, in the current era. This was back in the early 1900s. So this edition of the Proceedings of the Hawaiian Entomological Society describes the discovery of the banana-eating species Omedes mariki. And according to the proceedings, very few caterpillars hatched from these eggs, however, as nearly all were parasitized. So The banana-eating species were already in trouble over 100 years ago when they were first discovered. And at this point, they haven't been seen in many years. So they're probably all extinct. And here are 20 of the 23 species. The other three species I don't have any photos of because they don't exist. But you can see the ones that are in the orange colored labeling, those are the three banana eating species that I have a picture of. And they all look like pretty drab looking moths. And these are some color pictures of a few species that I found online. So they're just sort of brown, drabby looking moths. And the caterpillars look like this. And they're sort of green because they eat green food. Okay, so it turns out that all the caterpillars of the Eumedes genera are called leaf rollers. Okay? Because what they do is they make silken threads and they roll up the leaf. You can see the leaf is sort of rolled up, and then they can eat sort of in private. Where, you know, it's a lot of work, but it's better than being eaten. Okay, so that's what they do. Now, how many specialized mouth parts are required to eat different kinds of leaves? Do you need a specialized mouth part to eat a banana leaf versus a palm leaf? Probably not. Yes.
So when they say they eat the bananas, they just eat the leaves. They don't eat.
Right. They're leaf rollers. They only eat the leaves. They don't eat bananas. See now. You know you saw the picture where there was the peeled banana and the moth sitting on it. No, they don't do that. But I thought that would be funny.
That would require a special mouth.
Okay. Now actually there are species of moths that have special mouth parts for piercing fruit. Okay, but it's not any of these. Okay, so the next question is how much evolution has actually happened? And so the main claim at this point seems to be that if you eat bananas, then you must be somehow related. So they tend to think that all the banana eating species evolved separately, so they should all be related, right? And depending on what they eat, they're probably related to each other. So the question about eating food versus phylogeny, which is the relationship among species, is actually answered somewhat in this article, which was published in 2012. And in the article, they examined 81 taxa, including 10 Hawaiian species, for the genetic similarity. Unfortunately, they didn't look at any banana-eating species because those don't exist. Okay, so, but we do have some data. And what they did is they took these five genes. And the reason why they picked these five genes is because they have higher than average genetic variability. So in other words, these are sort of rapidly variable genes, so you can actually, you know, go in and sequence the genes and you'll get differences between different species, and so you can determine how closely related they are. Okay, so this graph, you can see here that the genes are on the bottom. You see them labeled on the bottom. And the y-axis, or the height of the bars, is related to genetic variability. The higher the bar, the more genetic variability. And these are two genera that are related to Eumedes. the green bars are the genetic variability of the Eumedes species outside of Hawaii. So it's all the species that exist in Australia and Papua New Guinea and all the different areas. And the purple bars is the genetic variability of the Hawaiian Eumedes species, the 10 species that they picked. So you can see they have less genetic variability, which is probably what you would expect anyway. But they also mentioned in the article that any of the geographically contiguous species tended to have less genetic variability anyway. But they never published that, so we don't know exactly what it was in other areas. But what they did is they generated phylogenetic trees. Have any of you ever seen one of these things? Okay, so what I want to do here is sort of go through how you would interpret this tree to get useful information out of it. So you'll notice there's a bunch of species names, and there are some bars that attach to those species names. So, for instance, if you look at those two species with the arrow, you'll notice that if you go to the branch point on the end, you'll see that those are connected. Okay. So what that tells you is that those two species are very similar to each other. Okay? They're on the same branch point, and they're connected to each other. Now, if you go up one level, you'll see the species below that is connected at the next branch point. So those are related to each other, but not as closely. Does everybody get that? Okay. Because we're going to use that information to look at the Hawaiian species. So if you look at this chart and you look at the very top, you'll see that's where the Hawaiian ommetes are. They're at the top of the chart. They're all clustered together there. And they're also somewhat clustered with the Australian ommetes. So this is a close-up of that part of the chart. And so what I've done here is I've listed not only the species, but also what they eat. Okay, because, you know, in theory, what they eat is supposed to be related somehow to phylogeny. So what you'll notice from the Hawaiian grouping is that there are two major groups here. So we can see that there's a group on top, the four species on top, and then there's a bunch of species in the second group. Now, the interesting thing about this clustering is that we have grass-eating species on the top cluster. We also have them on the bottom cluster. So is the species you eat, is that related to phylogeny? Probably not. Okay, we also have lilies on the top, lilies on the bottom. Now, we have these two species, Scotiae and Blackburnii, and they cluster together. You can see they cluster together. One of them eats lilies, and the other one eats palms. Okay, so the hypothesis that somehow the food source is related to phylogeny, does that seem to be true? No. Okay. Okay, some other interesting things here. So Blackburnii is not only is it a pest of coconut palms, but it also eats bananas. So the question is, you know, did it have to evolve to eat both of those kinds of leaves? Probably not. Okay. Ommetes accepta originally ate grasses and sedges. And now it's eating sugarcane, which is a problem because, you know, farmers don't like their sugarcane being eaten by caterpillars. Anybody know when sugarcane was introduced into the Hawaiian Islands? Okay, so yeah, it was about 150 years ago. So this species evolved to eat sugarcane in 150 years. Isn't that amazing? Are you all amazed? Okay.
Richard, huh? Are you going to mention legumes, how different it is at the top?
Oh, actually, okay, Mark
totally.
Mark pointed out that legume, okay, that's the only species that eats dicots.
The beans and peas.
Yeah, and this legume, it's not like a bean or a pea. Yeah. It looks sort of like an orchid. It's a very pretty plant. Okay, it's sort of clustered off on its own, so it's not really clustering with the other species, which is not really surprising. Okay, so the data shows that food source is not related to phylogeny. So, what did Kenneth Miller get wrong? He got the species wrong. He got the number of species wrong. He got the specialized mouth parts wrong. He got the changing the food source requires evolution wrong. So what did he get right? The only possible thing that he got right is that these species eat bananas. But since the species are extinct, they've never done the experiment to see if it only eats bananas. So this is, by anyone's imagination, this is an evolutionary epic fail.
Where did he get specialized? Where does that?
He made it up. He just totally just made it up. What else could he get it from? It's not anywhere. He just made it up. I can't believe this, you know? So, I don't know.
So he was the first one to mention the mouthpiece.
Yes. None of the other ones have the specialized mouth parts. Yeah, I don't know, John.
I think there's just more reasons to regard evolution as fairy tale science. Fairy tale.
Okay, but we have more to do here. We just have lots of examples, and we want to get through them all because we're going to have just a lot of fun. Yes, Al.
How many biologists agree with you on that, or with him?
I don't know. They read Zimmerman's article and said possible evolution, and they believed it. You know, nobody's ever looked at this question in depth. You know, you have to go into the original articles, read them, do a lot of searches. You know, I spent a couple months on this to pull this out. Okay, our next evolutionary fail is speciation of goat's beard. Now, you've all heard of this too, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Now, these species were supposed to have evolved since 1940. And actually, if you take an evolution class, they will probably talk about this. And you can find this mentioned on the Talk Origins website. Anybody ever heard of that? Talk Origins? Okay, well, this is a very famous website, and it's highly pro-evolution. There are hundreds and hundreds of articles on here, and it was one of the main early websites promoting evolution. Okay, so here's the story on their website. Three species of wildflowers called goat's beards were introduced to the United States from Europe shortly after the turn of the century. That was the 20th century. Within a few decades, their populations expanded and began to encounter one another in the American West. Whenever mixed populations occurred, the species interbred, hybridizing, producing sterile hybrid offspring. Suddenly, in the late 40s, two new species of goat's beard appeared near Pullman, Washington. Although the new species were similar in appearance to the hybrids, they produced fertile offspring. The evolutionary process had created a separate species that could reproduce, but not mate. Okay, I'm having trouble with my power supply. I just don't want it to go off and die. Okay. So there's this new species that was created that could reproduce, but it couldn't mate with the old ones. So this sounds like evolution, right? I mean, what else could it be? So here's what we have. We have Tragopogon pratensis, which combined with Tragopogon dubius to form the new species Tragopogon micellus. Okay? So you can see they all look radically different, right? No, they don't. Okay. But the interesting thing was that they couldn't combine with each other. Okay? It seems like there was some kind of radical evolutionary happening here, right? And it's speciation in action, right? Because, you know, the classic definition of a species is that it can't mate with another species. So there it is, right? Evolution is proven. Okay, so in order to understand what actually happened here, we need to understand how sexual reproduction works. Okay, most of you take in high school biology, so this is going to be a review. Now, most species are diploid. Everybody knows that, what that means? Diploid means you have two of something. So that's two of each chromosome. Okay, so that's a diploid. And goatbeard species have six pairs of chromosomes. So you can see them up there on the screen. That's the diploid organism. And we're going to look at what happens in normal cell division, which is called mitosis. And what happens is the chromosomes get duplicated, and then the cell divides. Okay? So then we have two cells, two daughter cells that have identical chromosomes. Again, we went from diploid to diploid. Okay, that's mitosis. Now, in the sex cells, or the gametes, there's a final division which is reductive. So what happens, instead of there being a chromosome duplication, we just have a separation of the pairs of chromosomes. So this produces the gametes, and the gametes are haploid. Okay, so they only have one copy of each chromosome. Okay, so when the gametes come together, you end up with a new organism that again is diploid. Okay, so it has the 12 chromosomes, six chromosome pairs. Okay, everybody gets that, right? Okay, now we're going to look at what happened in goat's beards. So here we have our two goat's beard species, and these are the gametes from each of those species. So we have haploid numbers of chromosomes here. We're going to combine them together, and we're getting Morse code. Okay, so here we have the hybrid. But the hybrid, the chromosomes are not identical. So the hybrid, it will grow into a full-sized plant, but when it comes to meiosis on this set of chromosomes will not work because it doesn't see the chromosomes as being identical. So this plant can grow, but it can't reproduce. Okay, so that's why it's called a sterile hybrid. Okay. So what happened?
Just the point on that previous one is you say it cannot reproduce itself to another organism, but it looks to me like it can't do the mitosis because you don't have those pairs.
No, in mitosis, they get replicated. So they get replicated so that you end up with pairs. Yes. Yeah, you'll end up with pairs. So it does work in mitosis. It doesn't work in meiosis. Okay. So going on, we're going to look at what happened to form this tetraploid hybrid. So what happened was we have our two species and what happened was that instead of getting the reductive cell division on the final division, it did a regular cell division. Okay, so we ended up with gametes that were actually diploid. Okay, is that amazing? So here we have our diploid gametes. What happens when these diploid gametes came together? It ended up, we now have a tetraploid organism. Okay? So it's gone from 12 chromosomes to 24 chromosomes.
almost human.
Hmm? Yes, it's becoming almost human. Okay, so when this actually happened, how much new information was included in this new species? How much new information? None, right? The chromosomes came from each species. They just came together. There's no new information here. We just have twice as much of the information that was there before. Okay, so why can't this tetraploid organism backcross with the original species? Let's look at that. So here we have our two original species on the top. We have meiosis. We have the haploid number. And here our new species, micellus. We have meiosis. And we have our haploid number for that species. What happens when these gametes come together?
Ouch.
Okay, so you can see that one of the two pairs up, but the other one doesn't. Okay, so this organism is going to fail, because as soon as it tries to do division, it's going to be very unhappy. Okay, so that's it. It was simply a chromosome duplication event that produced this tetraploid species.
How often does that occur anywhere?
It actually, in plants, it occurs fairly often. So it's not super unusual.
Based on that, will that new hybrid plant fail? Is it molded?
No, it just has twice as many chromosomes. It probably doesn't use all the chromosomes, but it doesn't matter. As long as you have enough to do everything you need to do, it's going to work.
Richard, you know, that's one of the reasons it's so difficult to define a species, especially in plants.
Yeah.
You can have all this interplay.
You can have all these weird things happening. Okay, so you guys know about bananas? Have you ever seen a wild banana?
No.
Okay, wild bananas have seeds. How come the bananas that we eat don't have any seeds?
Genetically modified?
There was a chromosome duplication. But instead of getting a tetraploid organism, you ended up with a triploid organism. A triploid organism has the same problems that this other triploid had. Okay, so bananas, the kinds that we eat, they cannot reproduce. So how do we have more banana trees?
Grafting?
Yes, you just slice a piece off, you plant it, and that's how all the bananas are grown. Isn't that amazing? Okay, anyway, back to the original story. So the origination of the new species of goat's beard was due simply to a single genetic event that created a tetraploid plant. And the chromosome mismatch prevented the parental backcross, which made it into a new species. And so no new information was created. So in my opinion, this is an evolutionary epic fail.
Failure. Epic failure, yeah.
Do evolutionists have an argument to that?
Well, you know, if you look on the Talk Origins website, you won't see the details about how this species came to be. You know, you have to go into the original articles to figure out that, yeah, it was just a chromosome duplication event. They don't tell you that because they want you to think that this was some huge evolutionary change that happened. And it wasn't, you know. They're just trying to deceive you.
Well, wouldn't they say
it was a new species. It's absolutely correct. It was a new species. But there wasn't any evolution that happened there. Okay.
Understandable as to maybe if you could have shown how a virus that evolves so when you give it penicillin, it'll fight it, and the next time it'll be penicillin proof.
more or less.
Viruses don't have anything to do with penicillin. Those are bacteria. But anyway, this talk is about examples of evolutionary failures. These are supposed to be good things. These are things that are supposed to prove evolution is true. So I'm just taking those for now, and okay. We can get on to your particular points of evolution if you want, and I can do another talk on those. Yes.
My understanding of evolution is the presentation of the original model. However, you know, like we have through the course of this class have talked about things that are really not evolution. But is there a absolute example of evolution out there, or is it really doesn't exist? Is there something that has evolved that we all agree on?
Well, these are things that are supposed to be good examples. So, you know, other people might have different lists, but I just want to go through this list, because this list is the one that I found that is just totally not real. Okay, so on to number three. Okay, so most of you took high school biology.
Years ago.
And that's actually a good thing for this part of it, because you were probably taught ontology recapitulates phylogeny. How many of you were taught that that is a true thing?
You're in her fish. There's a series, You're in Her Fish, that's on public broadcast.
Oh, I'm sure there is. Okay, so I actually remember this when I was in high school biology in 1968, because it seemed like the most bizarre thing to me. You know, I love biology, but this part seemed like totally wacko. And you know, I was only a high school kid, and it didn't make any sense to me. But let's look at how this has changed. So there's a modern version of the story, and it comes from a concept that was first developed by Carl von Baer in 1828. And according to this theory, embryos go through a kind of evolutionary hourglass. Okay, so you have your individual species here. They go through the hourglass, and they pass through what is called a common phylotypic stage. Okay, so there's supposed to be a common stage that all the embryos go through before they become their specific species. Okay, so that's the current version of the theory. Now, the idea was made famous by Ernst Haeckel, whose drawings of embryos have made it into textbooks for years and years, and you probably saw this drawing in your biology textbook. Mm-hmm. At least I remember seeing it, and it's pretty impressive. You know, here, these are the different species that we have here, and the phylotypic stage is the stage on top. It's the tail bud stage, and this is the stage where all the embryos are supposed to look alike, right? I mean, they all look alike, right? Okay. This is Ernst Haeckel's drawings. Okay, and you know the concept is still being taught today. In this textbook, Butler and Gerling say embryos of different species of vertebrate pass through identical embryonic stages before acquiring their specific features.
Well, but
look alike means big things. You know, it impresses people that things look alike. Okay, but here's one of Haeckel's detractors. His name is Adam Sedgwick, and in the 19th century, he said that even a blind man could distinguish between vertebrate embryos. So obviously not everybody agreed with Haeckel. And more recently, Gavin De Beer in Embryos and Ancestors says there are no grounds for this view. So surprisingly, scientists really hadn't looked at the issue in depth until this paper came out in 1997. And so the data that you're going to see is from this paper. And it shows the different embryos of different kinds of species. Okay, so this is a comparison of fish embryos, and these are all photographed to scale. Okay, Heckel's were not to scale, that was for sure. He just sort of, you know, tried to make them all the same size. But these are done to scale, and these are done at the exact same stage of embryogenesis. Okay, so they're all tail bud stage. So these fish, not even the fish all look the same. Right? Not even close. Okay, so let's look at amphibia. No, they don't look the same either. What's going on here? Okay, maybe the reptiles all look the same. No. Okay, what about birds? They sort of look a little bit the same, more than the other ones. Okay, and finally, mammals. There we go. They don't all look the same, do they? Okay. So, now that we have all these embryos, let's line them up with Heckel's drawings. I think he fudged. Okay, so in conclusion, there is no common phylotypic stage for vertebrate embryos, and Ernst Haeckel photoshopped his drawings. That was a little bit before Photoshop, but he did do that. Yes, he was ahead of his time. So, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny is an evolutionary epic fail. They taught the modern version, but even the modern version isn't correct.
More modern version than this?
No, well, it was the common phylotypic stage. That's still being taught.
Yes. It's still being taught.
It is, but it's not.
You'll still find drawings and call it
text. Yeah, you still.
Okay, we have one more, and we're doing really well because I didn't think we'd get to it. But,
can I ask you a quick question?
Yes.
So did Haeckel make up those pictures?
He was on Ill.
He sort of did, didn't he?
So he really wasn't copying anything.
No, he copied them, then he wanted to make them look closer to what they look like, to each other. So he fudged it. Pretty simple, yeah.
It's like the Barn Canal.
Okay, so now we're going on to number four. How many of you have read Icons of Evolution? Okay, you know that the peppered moths are in there. Okay. Some of the details in there are true, but what was your impression of, is the peppered moth a good example of natural selection?
Does it survive?
Is it a good example of natural selection?
No.
Okay. So if you read Icons of Evolution, they sort of insinuate that it's not a good example of natural selection, and they give you lots of reasons why and stuff. But most of those are not good.
Not
okay.
Valid or not good?
Not valid.
It's
okay. So yeah, we're going to get into that part too. But we're going to look at two questions here. One is the natural selection part, and the other is the evolution part. Okay. So it could be a good example of natural selection, but a really bad example of evolution. So so it's. Okay, so here's the story. Prior to 1848 in Britain, virtually all the peppered moths were speckled with both black and white scales. And in that, but in that year, there was a darker form called carbonaria, which appeared. And here's what a carbonaria would look like on a lichen-covered branch. Okay, so you can see it pretty well. Okay, but the typica variety sort of blends in. Whoa, where did that come from? Where did it go? Okay, so yeah, those are pretty hidden. And you guys can all see this moth too, right? Okay, so that's another one. So they blend in pretty well. Okay, so here you can see this is the carbonaria version, which is dark, and it's sitting on a dark branch. And if you compare that to the peppered version, the peppered version shows up pretty well on this dark branch. Okay, so what happens was in the mid-1800s, the Industrial Revolution took off in Britain. And it produced, you know, lots of pollution because they were burning coal and stuff. And so they ended up with all the lichen in the forest near the industrial centers being killed. So the lichen dies off, the soot gets all over the trees, and the trees became dark. So instead of having the light-colored lichen on them, they became dark trees. And the particular carbonaria version replaced the typica by up to 98% in the polluted forest. However, clean air legislation was passed in the 1950s, and that resulted in a reduction of pollution. The lichen came back on the trees, and the carbonaria went from 90% in 1970 to less than 20% by 1995. Okay, there were two main theories that were proposed to explain industrial melanism in these peppered moths. Initially, the scientists thought that some of the industrial pollutants were changing the development of the moth so that the moth became brown. Seems unlikely. Some people did some experiments, other scientists tried to repeat it, and it never really flew. However, in 1896, James Tutte proposed that natural selection was responsible for the change in frequencies of these two varieties of peppered moths. And he proposed that birds were the selective agents. So in other words, the birds were picking off the moths that they could see the easiest, which explained why one species was going, one variety was going up and one variety was going down. And John Haldane, who's a famous evolutionist from the like 30s and stuff, he calculated that carbonaria had to have a higher fitness by 30 to 50%, which is that's a huge number. Okay, so that's why this percentage changed so quickly. And there's some other reasons too, which we'll get to soon. Okay, so the first person to actually look at the question of natural selection as a means of changing the frequencies of the carbonaria and typica is Bernard Kettlewell. And he did a few experiments over a few years. And one of the experiments he did was he looked at human observations of the moths to determine which moths were easier to see. Now, the question is, you know, birds are supposed to be the natural selecting agent. Who sees better, birds or humans?
Birds.
You know why birds see better?
So they won't become afraid themselves.
No, what is the mechanism that a bird can see better than a human?
The retina. Yeah.
Is it just visual acuity?
No, it's where the retina is located.
Okay, well, it's also, there's something else. Birds can see in ultraviolet. Is that cool or what? You know, the world looks totally different in ultraviolet. And we have no idea what that is because we can't see it. Okay, so he was using human observers to look at these moths, and what they found was that on the oak, the Titica, the light-colored version, was much more visible than the dark-colored version. Not surprising, right? And on birch, which is a light wood, you know, it's reversed. You can see the carbonaria much easier than the Typica. Okay, these are some of the photos from Kettlewell's studies from his paper. And here there are two moths, right? You can see the carbonaria pretty well, and the Typica is sort of hard to see. So this is these are the two versions on lichen, and these are the two versions on darkened wood. Okay?
That was normal light, not
UV. No, that was normal light, yeah. I don't think he had any UV cameras or anything at that time. Okay, so this graph shows the frequency of Typica and Carbonaria in polluted and unpolluted forests. So as you can see, in the polluted forest, the Carbonaria far outnumber the Typica. In the unpolluted forest, it's reversed. Okay, so that goes along with the hypothesis that, you know, it has something to do with being able to be seen and being preyed on by some kind of creature that's using vision. Okay. And in the experiments that he did another kind of experiment where he marked and released the two different kinds of moths. Okay, so he marked them so that he could see that those were the ones that he had released, and then he collected them. And then he assumed that the ones that he didn't collect were eaten or died or something. So this graph shows the results of his mark and release experiments. So in the polluted woods, he was getting back mostly carbonaria, which is what you would expect. They're the dark variety. In the unpolluted woods, he was getting back Typica. Okay? So this goes along with the hypothesis that we have some kind of bird predation. And these kinds of studies were also replicated by other researchers in the field. Okay, which I don't know if Icons of Evolution tells you that. Okay, now one of the other researchers is Lawrence Cook, and he kept 40 years of records of carbonaria frequencies in leaves. Okay, so it was near a polluted area, but again we have, you know, the pollution going away, and this is the frequency of carbonaria over time. So you can see it was 100% in the 1960s. By 2003, it was down to pretty much nothing. Okay, so this also goes along with that data. Now, Kettlewell's experiments had some problems. And so what he did is he released too many moths at too few sites. So this resulted in what has been called the bird's dinner table effect. And moths were released onto tree trunks, okay, which normally, you know, some of them will land on tree trunks, but a lot of them will land on lateral branches. So that was another complaint. The other complaint was that they were released during the day, whereas these moths are night flying moths. So they would usually select their landing point, you know, right before dawn. But, you know, the researchers didn't want to get up before dawn. I mean, you know, let's be realistic here. Okay, so he also used mixtures of captured versus lab-bred moths. And, you know, you never know when you breed a moth in the lab if it's going to behave exactly the same. And obviously, in different forests, you had different percentages of moss. So he translocated moss from one forest to the other because he couldn't get enough in the forest, in the opposite forest. So we don't know how those might behave because they might have some different local adaptation. And finally, some people have objected to the idea that maybe the birds aren't the primary predator. Because, you know, the moths fly at night, and what flies at night? Bats. Okay, so maybe the bats are doing the predation. Okay, so we're going to look at the bat question first, because I think it's really fun. Okay, so who knows, how do bats hunt? Okay, by sound. Okay, and when they're hunting at night, how much are they seeing? You ever heard the expression blind as a bat?
No.
Okay. You see the bat's eye here?
Barely.
Yes. They have very small eyes. What about those big things coming out the top of their head? Ears. Okay. So just by looking at this, you might think that this animal hunts by hearing, right? Okay. So would we expect bats to preferentially pick Carbonaria versus Typica or vice versa?
No,
we wouldn't. Okay, so why did these people come up with this idea? I don't know. Okay, so this is actually the graph, and researchers looked at bat predation in different forests at different times, and there is no difference.
Can bats see in the ultraviolet though?
Bats can't see.
No,
they don't have to see.
But they can see. They have an eye.
Well, they have an eye, but it's not. They don't use it for hunting.
Especially
if
an eye.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So, and one researcher has been interested in this. Question for a number of years. His Michael Madras, and he did a 6-year study using almost 5,000 moths. Okay, this was his life for 6 years. And so what he did is he released the moths at low density. He had 103 sites instead of a few, and he released one moth at each site. One moth. That's low density. That's about as low a density as you can get. And the moths were released where they normally rested. So some went to the tree trunks, some went on the branches, wherever. and he got up at night and did this. So this guy is really dedicated here. Okay. And so I don't know. So, but binocular observations showed that 26% of the moths were eaten by birds. Okay, so this is going along with the hypothesis.
Those by nightingales?
No. He did the binocular observations at dawn.
Okay.
So he could actually see what's happening. But, you know, you have to do something. So here are the results of the study. And we can see the Typica are on the top, the Carbonaria are on the bottom, and this was done in a forest which was not polluted. So the results are what you would expect. You're recovering more of the light colored moths and fewer of the dark colored moths. So that shows that the peppered moth is really an excellent example of natural selection in action. Okay? Everybody gets that, right? We're done with the bats, Al. Okay. So, what's been missing from the story is how much evolution has actually occurred. So how much evolution? You know, and How much information?
Yeah, no new information.
Well, how do you know that? Do you have any data? Okay.
Let me tell you about the study.
So many creationists say that carbonaria is a natural variation. Is that true? Okay. So actually, some molecular biologists got involved in this, and that's my favorite part. So, and what they wanted to do is they want to find out what kind of mutations produce this massive evolutionary change. So what's the number one gene that you would think of? Anybody knows what causes pigment?
The gene name?
Anybody ever heard of melanoma?
Yes.
Okay, melanin. Melanin is the common pigment gene. So they looked at the melanin gene, and they did a GWAS study, and it wasn't the melanin gene. Oh no, not that. So the next thing I want to do is they wanted to do an entire study. You know, rather than just looking at a specific gene, which wasn't the cause, let's go look at all the genes and find out where it is. So, this is the paper. And the paper actually looks at this question. So here's the results of the paper. And what they found is the carbonaria mutation, you can see there, is a single base pair mutation on chromosome 17, and it happened to land in the region that determines wing patterning. Okay, so how the pattern on the wings form. And what they determined through some different kinds of looking at different groups of species and stuff is they determined that that this event was like a one-time event that happened in the recent past, because the differences between the carbonaria and the typica were really, really small in other areas of the genome. Okay, so it probably happened just right before the Industrial Revolution, so that these moths sort of lucked out. But like most evolutionary changes, the evolutionary change, the one base pair change, it broke the wing patterning gene. It just broke it. That's all it did. Is that dramatic?
Yeah.
Okay.
Did it add anything new?
No, it broke the gene. So the pattern never happened because the gene was broken. Oh. Lovely, huh? That's evolution for you. So the peppered moth represents an excellent example of natural selection. However, the peppered moth mutation was not the result of some massive evolutionary change. It was a one base pair change. That's it. Single base pair. It could have been anywhere. Okay. So, from an evolutionary viewpoint, the peppered moth is an epic fail.
Would it be fair to assume that this made it more difficult for the new species, if it were, to survive because of not having that coloration on the wings?
Well, it makes it hard if you're landing on lichen and birds see you and eat you. But it's not a new species.
Well,
it's the identical species. It's just a single base pair mutation.
So can they interbreed?
It's a change within
the term. They can interbreed, and the interesting thing is the carbonaria mutation is dominant. So if a carbonaria interbreeds with a typica, all the offspring are carbonaria.
So the same species.
Yeah. Exact same species. There's one base pair difference, John.
But there's a difference.
Nobody's asked the question where they have red hair.
Oh, we're not going on hair.
You're just like you.
Yeah, but there is a difference in the base pair of the.
No, there's a difference in one base pair.
Well, that's
one base pair out of billions. There's one base pair.
What?
Is that evolution?
Yeah.
No. Okay. So,
you could argue it's micro, maybe evolution, but not.
Oh, it's just a mutation.
Just a variation.
Yeah, it broke the gene, so it made them black. Lovely. Okay. You know, if it had made them speckled brown and black, then it would have been pretty impressive. But it didn't. It just broke the gene. So the question is, what does all this mean? Does it mean that evolution is false?
No.
But it does mean, you know, if these are the best examples of evolution, where are the real ones? Okay. So okay, we are out of time.
But your hair is a different color than mine. One of us is human and one is not.
Are you announcing?
Rich.
Well, let's close in prayer. Dear Lord, we are very thankful for the creation that you have made, and cells and biology is just such a fascinating topic, Lord. And it's so complex, but we're so very thankful for scientists digging in and discovering more and more about the complexity of cells and the complexity of life. We're so very thankful that you knew us and knit us together and produced us individually with our gifts and our talents. And we're so very thankful that we can come together and be in the body of Christ, even though we're so very different, because we're one in you. And so we're very thankful for the unity that we find in you, Lord, in your grace and your mercy and your love. And we find unity in that. And we're so very thankful for Holy Week, where we can celebrate that, Lord. Be with Hugh as he travels, and we look forward to seeing him next week. Amen.